This is Audible.
Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Legend of Pearly Gates by William W. Johnstone with J. A. Johnstone. Narrated by Danny Campbell. Chapter 1. Howdy, Pearly! Ben Henderson sang out when he saw the familiar figure walk into his general store in the little settlement of Paris, Texas. Ben, Pearly returned. I've got a list of things we need. Some flour, salt, sugar, and such. It's right here on this list. He handed the list to Ben. Reckon you can read it as well as me calling 'em out. That I can, Ben said. Looks like your mother's handwriting, and anybody can read that. How are your folks? Your paw still down on his back? Never mind his paw. A harsh voice came from the other end of the store, where the hardware and ammunition were located. You're supposed to be waiting on me, and I don't see no 44 cartridges on these shelves. Pearly had not noticed the two men near the back shelves. He looked then to see them, neither of whom he had ever seen in town before. Ma's fine, he answered Ben quickly. But Pa's come down with something he can't seem to get rid of. You go ahead and wait on those two fellas. I'm not in any big hurry. Henderson hurried over to the end of the counter. Yes, sir. Boxes of 44 cartridges right here on the shelf, he said, and pointed to them. If they'd have been a snake, they'd have bit you. He laughed good-naturedly, but stopped when it was obvious the strangers didn't appreciate his attempt to lighten the atmosphere. Yes, sir. How many boxes? While he was biding his time at the front counter, Pearly remembered something he had promised his younger sister, Esther, he would ask about. Figuring he needed a woman's help with that, he asked Ben. Is Mrs. Henderson around? I'm going to need some help with some material. Yeah, Pearly, Ben answered. She's in the stockroom. He called out then, Shirley! It obviously irritated Ben's ammunition customer, who said nothing, but the hard look he shot Pearly's way was enough to send a message. Pearly decided he'd better wait patiently. But it was too late, because Shirley Henderson popped through the stockroom door immediately. Pearly's gonna need some help with some dress material, Ben said. Well, hello, Pearly, Shirley said. I haven't seen you in town in a long time. How's your mother and father? Is he over that fall yet? Pearly started to answer, but was interrupted before he was able to. His mama's doing just fine, and his papa's still in the damn bed, the gruff voice blurted. Now are you going to get me those damn cartridges or not? Two boxes. I ain't wasting my time all day in this store. No need to get cross, neighbor, Ben said as he hurried to get the cartridges. Anything else I can do for you? While the stranger was paying Ben, Shirley gave Pearly a raised eyebrow, but carried on cheerfully. That dress pattern came in. I suppose you want to pick that up. Yes, ma'am, Pearly answered, trying to remember if Esther had given him any other instructions. I need to see if you've got some dress material in a deep blue. We got some in, Shirley said. Are you thinking about a navy blue or something a shade lighter? I don't know, Pearly replied. Esther hadn't given him that much information. He followed Shirley over to another counter where bolts of cloth and sewing things were kept. The two strangers, both trail-hardened cowhands from the looks of them, turned to stare at him in open scorn. Will there be anything else? Ben asked. No, reckon not, the big one replied. I was thinking about looking at some of your fancy lace, or some pretty bows or something. But I reckon I'll do that some other time. His friend cracked up over the remark, and they both roared with laughter. They were still laughing when they headed toward the door. Maybe I'll knit some booties to put on my horse, the big one said loudly as they went out. I'm sorry about that, Ben said. Sorry about what? Pearly asked. Ben looked surprised. Those two Jaspers, he said. They were a rough-looking pair, and I'm sorry they took to japing you like that. But I'll be honest with you, they look like too much for me to handle. Were they japing me? Pearlie asked. I reckon I wasn't paying enough attention to know it. Don't pay 'em no mind. Just some cowhands in town to dust off some rust. They most likely didn't mean any harm. Ben exchanged a puzzled glance with his wife and shook his head. I think this blue is more what Esther is looking for, Shirley said. Looks good to me, Pearlie said. Cut off however much the pattern calls for. I've got to pick up something from Patton's. I'll go do that while you're getting my order ready. He left the buckboard at the rail in front of Henderson's and walked up the street past the post office to Patton's saloon. Howdy, Pearlie. Paul McQueen, the blacksmith, called out when Pearlie walked by. Pearlie returned the greeting but continued on to the saloon. As long as he was picking up a pattern and material for Esther, he thought he might as well surprise her with one of her favorite treats. Patton's was an odd place to get it, but in Paris, it was the only place. Pearlie might have considered having a drink while he was there, but it was a little early in the day for him. Another reason was of a more personal nature. Any time he came to town, especially if alone, he made it a point to eat dinner at the Paris diner, and he didn't like to have whiskey on his breath when he ate there. He wouldn't want Lucy Tate to smell it on him. According to his railroad watch, he had about the right amount of time to make a quick stop in Patton's, then return to Henderson's to pick up his supplies. That should put him at the diner right when they opened for the midday meal. A picture of Lucy Tate floating cheerfully around the dining room immediately took over Pearlie's mind. Sometimes he couldn't clear his brain of the diner's young waitress, and he was certain that she had similar feelings for him. She never failed to give him special attention when he came in, even to the point of sitting down at the table with him to visit. Pearlie was the only one of Nathaniel Gates's grown sons who was not married, and Pearlie felt that maybe it was time to think about things like that. Reuben and John were lucky that they had found good women to build their families with. He just hadn't met that special woman yet, but maybe Lucy was meant to fill that void in his life. There were two saddled horses and one pack horse tied at the rail in front of Patton's. It was early for the afternoon customers, and already late for the dedicated drunks who opened up the saloon. Pearlie stepped up onto the boardwalk and went inside, where he found Raymond Patton sitting at a table against the wall, drinking coffee. "Morning, Pearlie," Patton greeted him. "Morning," Pearlie returned with a nod, then went straight to the bar to speak to Benny Grimes, the bartender. "Howdy, Pearlie," Benny said. "Ain't seen you in town in a while." "Reckon not," Pearlie said. "We're kind of busy this time of year, getting the cattle ready for the drive up to Ogallala." "I figured as much," Benny said. "Ain't seen much of any of your crew. What'll you have, whiskey?" "Little too early," Pearlie answered. "I just came in to buy a couple of those big peppermint sticks you keep for Mrs. Patton." At the other end of the long bar, Zeke Cotton nudged the man drinking beside him with his elbow. "Looky there," he drawled, making no attempt to muffle his comment. "Damned if that ain't that sweet little girly fella that was at the store buying some material to make him a dress." They both turned to stare at Pearlie, who was just in the process of taking the peppermint sticks and wrapping them in a piece of cloth that Benny had torn from a clean bar rag.
"I swear, Lige, ain't that plum precious?"
"It sure is," Lige replied, knowing there was going to be some fun to follow.
"Reckon he could do some sewing for us? I've got some socks that sure need darning, and he's the only seamstress we're liable to come across between here and the Red River."
"Maybe so," Lige said. "But what strikes me as kind of queer is, what the hell is he doing in a saloon? There ain't nobody but men supposed to be in a saloon." Their sarcasm became louder and louder, no matter that Pearlie ignored it.
"Wait a minute," Zeke exclaimed.
Maybe she is supposed to be in here. She might just be dressed up like a man. I think it'd be a good idea to pull them trousers off her and see if she is a woman.
When they started to move down the bar toward Pearlie, who was now facing them, it finally became too much for Raymond Patton to ignore. He got up from his chair and walked after them.
"Hold on there, men. There's no need for that kind of trouble in here."
Zeke turned to face him.
"Who the hell asked you? You'd best sit back down there and keep your mouth shut."
"I'm the owner of this saloon, and we don't stand for any harassing of our regular customers, so you'd best sashay right on out that door and don't come back."
"You're talking mighty big," Zeke said. "Maybe I ain't ready to get out till I take a look at what old Precious there has between his legs. What do you think about that?"
"I think you'll be a mess to clean up," Benny answered for his boss. "And it's my job to clean up around here." They turned back to see the double-barreled shotgun resting on the bar, with the bartender sighting in on them, both hammers cocked.
"Whoa, Zeke!" Lige recoiled. "I believe he means what he says. Maybe we'd best do what the man wants."
Zeke hesitated, unwilling to back down. But there was no chance against the cocked shotgun. He considered himself handy with a six-gun, but there was no use in committing suicide.
"All right," he finally conceded. "You got the jump on me this time, but this business ain't none of yours anyway. It's between me and Precious here."
He glared at Pearlie, who had said nothing up to that point.
"And you'd better stay clear of my path, 'cause next time I see you, you might have to use that gun you're wearing."
"Ain't no cause for you to threaten Pearlie," Patton said. "He ain't done nothing to rile you. Now you'd best be moving along before I send somebody to get the sheriff."
"We're going,"
Lige said, and grabbed Zeke by the arm.
"Come on, Zeke."
Zeke allowed himself to be pulled toward the door, while Benny's shotgun followed him all the way. When they passed close by Pearlie, Zeke growled,
"What did he call you, Precious? Pearlie? That's a good name for you. Pearlie Precious."
"Looks like we got off to a bad start, friend," Pearlie replied. "Most likely the liquor talking." Zeke laughed at Pearlie's weak response.
"You'd best stay out of my way if you see me coming," Zeke threatened. "Next time, you might not have somebody there to save you."
"That makes sense to me," Pearlie said. "I know I ain't got any desire to see you again." Lige pulled his friend out the door, and Benny followed to make sure they were leaving. In a few seconds, he reported that the two had gotten on their horses and ridden down toward the stable.
"Damn it, Pearlie," Raymond Patton said.
"I'm sorry you had to have something like that happen to you in my place. Those two drifters had no reason to start in on you."
"Just the whiskey talking," Pearlie said. "Don't think nothing of it. I didn't. I can't blame them for japing me a little about coming to the saloon to buy peppermint candy."
He picked his candy up from the counter and stuck it in his shirt pocket. "I'd best hurry on back to Henderson's now and pick up my order." When he got back to Henderson's store, he saw that Ben had loaded his packages in the back of the buckboard. "I appreciate that," he thought, for he was anxious to get down to the Paris diner, and now all he had to do was go in and pay for the merchandise. That took only a couple of minutes, and he said goodbye to the Hendersons. Back outside, Pearlie took a quick minute to say good morning to Jenny McQueen, the blacksmith's wife. She was in the process of scolding her 6-year-old son for playing around an old unused shack next to the store.
"I told him he could stay with his daddy at the shop, but every time Paul turns his back, this little mischief-maker winds up in this old snaky-looking shack. I declare, I wish Ben would tear it down."
"Yes, ma'am," Pearlie replied, taking time to be polite, even though he was eager to get to the diner.
Places like that old shack just naturally call to little fellas with a spirit of adventure. The youngster sidled back over to the door of the shack, while his mother was distracted and began pulling on it again. Pearlie was puzzled then by the inquisitive frown on Jenny's face as she seemed to be looking beyond him.
"Well, I'll be damned," Zeke Cotton drawled. "Look here, Lige. It's old Pearlie Precious."
Pearlie turned to discover the two drifters, who had walked their horses slowly up behind him while he had exchanged polite conversation with the blacksmith's wife. He had hoped they had left town, but it appeared they were going to be impossible to ignore.
"Reckon what they're talking about, Zeke?" Lige mocked. "Maybe they're exchanging recipes."
Pearlie knew he was going to be forced to deal with them, no matter how he tried to avoid it. Jenny seemed confused by their remarks, and Pearlie wished she would grab her kid and be on her way, but she remained.
"You fellas have had a good time japing me, but I reckon it's time for me to say that's enough. So what do you say you just ride on out of here now, and we'll all get back to our business?"
"Why, you," Zeke started. "I've had about enough of you. You want to get back to business, do you? Well, my business is taking care of smart-mouthed son of a bitches like you."
"I'll have to ask you to watch your language around the lady and the little boy," Pearlie said.
"You son of a bitch," Zeke spat. "You're wearing a gun, so you'd better get ready to use it, or I'm going to shoot you down where you stand."
He stepped down from his horse and handed Lige his reins.
"Go get 'em, Zeke," Lige jeered. "He ain't got the guts to stand up to you. He's most likely peeing in his britches right now."
Confident that Pearlie would turn and run instead of standing to fight, Zeke walked a few steps back toward the street and stood ready to duel.
"I asked you politely to watch your language. Now you're going to force me to do something that there ain't no call for at all," Pearlie said.
He looked at the woman, standing wide-eyed and stunned, and said,
"Jenny, take your son and walk away from here."
Seemingly paralyzed moments before, she suddenly realized that all hell was about to break loose. She turned to her son and screamed,
"Tommy!"
But it was too late. The huge rattlesnake coiled just beneath the rotted-out boards of the old shack was already set to strike the youngster poking around its nest. With no time to think, Pearlie spun around, drew his .44 and fired, splattering the rattler's head onto the walls of the shack. It happened in less than a second and left the two drifters as well as the shaken mother stunned. Pearlie twirled the pistol on his finger and dropped it back in the holster. Then he turned to face Zeke again. Unable to believe what he had just witnessed, Zeke found himself virtually paralyzed. It took Lige no more than a moment to realize Zeke was facing instant death.
"We're done here, mister. Come on, Zeke. We've got no more business in this town."
He tipped his hat to Jenny.
"Beg your pardon, ma'am, for our language."
Zeke, still suffering from the shock of the draw he had come close to facing, needed no further encouragement. Almost stumbling, he climbed onto his horse and followed Lige out the south end of the street, wanting no part in a shootout against a draw too fast to see. Still shaking, Jenny McQueen finally asked,
"Who were those men?"
"Ah, nobody important, I reckon," Pearlie replied,
greatly relieved that the trouble had gone no further.
"Just some drifters passing through town. I'm real sorry you had to hear their rough language. They most likely ain't been around civilized ladies like you in a long spell."
He looked at Tommy, clutching his mother's skirt now.
"Reckon this old shack ain't a good place to play. Looks like a family of rattlesnakes has moved in."
Pearlie looked up to see Paul McQueen running from his forge.
"Here comes your daddy now, so I guess I'll get along."
He climbed up in the buckboard since some other folks were running to investigate as well, and he didn't want to hang around to answer questions. Maybe your daddy will skin that snake, make you a nice belt, like the Indians do.
What was that shot I heard?
Paul asked excitedly when he ran up.
Just shot a snake, Paul, Pearlie answered. That's all it was. I think Tommy's thinking about skinning it.
He popped a horse with the reins, and the buckboard pulled off toward the diner. He tied the horse at the rail before the small frame structure with the sign that proclaimed it to be the Paris Diner. Most of the locals referred to it as Beulah's Kitchen, since it was owned and operated by Beulah Walsh. Pearlie stepped up onto the stoop, removed his hat, and brushed his hair as best he could with his fingers. This was an important day for Pearlie Gates, for he had made up his mind to let Lucy Tate know that he was interested in the two of them getting to know each other better. The slight distraction earlier with the two strangers had already left his mind, banished by his thoughts of developing something between himself and the attractive waitress. Lately, it seemed, she had not disguised her interest in him, so it couldn't hurt to let her know that he was attracted to her as well.
"You going in?" a voice behind him asked.
"Yes, sir. Excuse me. I was just trying to remember something."
Pearlie mumbled to the elderly man on the step behind him. He opened the door and held it for the man.
"After you, sir."
Pearlie stood there in the doorway for a few moments while he looked over the dining room. He didn't see either of the two waitresses, so he passed by the long table in the center of the room and sat down at one of the small tables against the wall. He usually sat at the long table, but on this day he preferred the privacy one of the side tables offered. In a minute or two, Becky Morris came from the kitchen with a full dish of potatoes. She set it down on the big table, then came over to greet Pearlie.
"Howdy, Pearlie. I didn't see you sneak in. What you doing sitting over here by yourself? Did they run you off from the big table?"
"Howdy, Becky," Pearlie answered. "I just thought it'd be easier to talk if I wasn't sitting in the middle of the big table."
"Where's Lucy? Ain't she working today?"
Becky smiled. "Yes, Lucy's working today. She's in the kitchen. I'll tell her you're here. First, I'll get you some coffee, though." She left to get his coffee.
"Thanks, Becky," Pearlie said when she came back with a steaming cup of coffee. Then she left him to tell Lucy he was there.
Pearlie watched the slight girl until she disappeared through the kitchen door. He liked Becky. She was always pleasant and cheerful, and almost always took the time to ask how his folks were doing. Thoughts of her were immediately lost a few seconds later, however, when Lucy Tate walked in from the kitchen.
"Well, hello there, stranger," Lucy called out as she approached his table. "I was wondering what happened to you. You haven't been in for so long. I brought you a plate of stew. If you don't mind waiting a few minutes, I've got a fresh batch of biscuits coming out of the oven."
Her smile seemed to warm the entire dining room.
"What you been up to?"
"Keeping out of trouble," she teased playfully. Standing in the kitchen door, Becky watched Lucy charming the unsuspecting young man, and it suddenly made her angry. Lucy was a friend of hers, and Becky didn't care how she turned her charm on the young man around the town. She just wished Lucy wouldn't lead Pearlie on. He was especially vulnerable to her flirting, seeing as how shy he was in a woman's presence.
"You know me," Pearlie said, "trying my best to stay out of trouble."
He swallowed hard, his mouth having suddenly gone dry as he realized he didn't know how to tell her what he had come to say.
"I wanted to come by to see you, before we get the cattle ready to drive to market," he finally managed. "I'll be gone for a couple of months, so I figured I'd best come in to talk to you before I go."
"About what?" she asked.
"You know," he stumbled, "about one thing and another." He had hoped she would know what he wanted to say. She had to know, and she wasn't making it easy on him. So he dived right in. "You know, I think a lot of you."
"Why? I think a lot of you, too, Pearlie,"
she replied. You're a good friend.
Well, I'm thinking maybe we could spend more time together. He came back weakly.
Are you trying to say what I think you are?
A mischievous smile parted her lips.
Yeah, I reckon I am, he confessed. I was just thinking, maybe I could call on you sometime when you ain't working.
Well, that's really sweet of you. But I'm not interested in you in that way. But thanks for the offer.
She smiled sweetly and walked back toward the kitchen. I'll check on the biscuits.
He felt as if he had been shot, and wished at that moment that he had been. He felt like a fool for having interpreted her flirting as genuine interest in him. Sick to his stomach, he stared at the full plate of stew before him, and knew he could not eat anything. He pushed his chair back and stood up, feeling that every eye in the room was on him. Knowing he had to escape, he shoved his hand in his pocket, pulled out some money to leave on the table, and headed for the door, his face flushed with shame.
"Pearlie, wait!"
Becky Morris ran after him.
"Wait, Pearlie," she pleaded, until he finally stopped to untie his horse from the rail.
"I left the money on the table," he said, "if that's what you want."
"I don't care about the money," Becky said. "I care about you. I know what just happened back there. You don't have to be ashamed of getting the wrong impression from Lucy's flirting. You're not the first. It's a game she enjoys playing, and it's a terrible thing to play on someone as decent as you."
He finally looked up to meet her eyes.
"Thanks, Becky.
I appreciate you coming to tell me. I just feel like a damn fool, and I want to find me a hole somewhere and crawl in it. I ain't nowhere near ready to court a woman anyway. I don't know what I was thinking. I know how it feels to be attracted to someone, and know they don't feel the same way about you," Becky said.
"You do?" Pearlie replied.
"Then I reckon that gives you and me something in common."
"That's right," Becky said. "That's something we'll always have between us. So don't let this keep you from coming back to the diner when you're in town. I always look forward to seeing you."
"Why, thank you, Becky. I appreciate it. Now I reckon I'd best haul this stuff back home, before John or Reuben send somebody to look for me."
He climbed up on the buckboard seat and turned the horse toward the street. She stood out in front of the diner and watched him, until she heard Lucy's voice behind her. "Hey, are you going to help with these dishes, or are you going to stand out here all day?"
Becky looked around to see Lucy standing in the doorway.
"He'll get over it," Lucy said.
"Lucy, you really are a bitch," Becky said.
"That's the most decent man in this county."
Lucy laughed.
"You think so, anyway."
Chapter 2 Rachel Gates walked out to the back porch, where her daughter was shelling peas for supper.
"Esther, go down to the barn and get your brothers. Tell them to come up to the house."
Esther was struck by her mother's grave manner. Spoken softly and calmly, her words conveyed a heavy sadness, causing Esther to drop the pan filled with peas and ask,
"Daddy?"
Her mother nodded solemnly.
"I'm afraid so," she murmured. "Go fetch your brothers."
Rachel hesitated a moment or two to watch Esther run toward the barn, oblivious of the spilled pan of peas half-shelled lying on the ground at the foot of the steps. She turned then and went back to the bedroom, where her husband, Nathaniel Gates, lay in eternal sleep. His death was not totally unexpected, for he had taken a turn for the worse over the last few days, when he appeared to have come down with a pneumonia-like fever that didn't seem related to his accident. Up until that time, the whole family assumed he would recover from being thrown by a horse, landing him hard on his neck.
It was not the first time he had been thrown, and every time before he had recovered, like the indestructible man that he had always been. Rachel placed her hand on her husband's cold brow, then gently closed the stark blue eyes that gazed into the world beyond the life he had known. She took a step back when her daughter-in-law appeared at the bedroom door. "What's wrong, Mama?" Lou Ann implored. Having seen Esther running to the barn, calling out to the men, she had paused only to pick up the pan of peas Esther had dropped before rushing into the house. "Is Papa all right?"
"He's gone," Rachel whispered, struggling to hold on to her emotions. "I just came in to see if he felt well enough to drink some coffee. And he was."
Unable to finish, she tried to hold back the tears that choked her. Luann stepped close and took her in her arms. They were both crying when Reuben and John ran into the room, with Esther close behind. Reuben, the eldest of Nathaniel and Rachel Gates's sons, moved at once to comfort the two women, with his arms around both of them. Right behind him, John paused to stare at his father, barely able to believe he was dead.
"Pearlie's down near the river, looking for a bunch of strays that wandered off after that thunderstorm last night," he said, his gaze still fixed on his father. "I sent Sonny to find him."
They were joined then by John's wife, Martha.
"What is it, John?"
she asked upon seeing them gathered in her father-in-law's bedroom.
"I was feeding the chickens when I heard you shouting to Sonny to go fetch Pearlie."
He held his arm out to her, and she, seeing something wrong, stepped inside his embrace.
"It's Papa," John said. "He's gone."
She gasped in response, even though she had already feared that to be the cause of the sudden gathering of the family. It was almost impossible to believe that the powerful head of the Gates family had succumbed to a fever that none of the family thought a serious threat. Nathaniel Gates, having grown up on the small farm his father had abandoned when Nathaniel's mother died, took it over and built it into the giant cattle ranch it was today. A small empire carved out of the Texas plains, it continued to grow under the hard work and guidance of Nathaniel's family, who were all gathered now in this sorrowful room, with the exception of one. Rachel, his widow. Reuben, the eldest son, with his wife Luann. John, 1 year younger than Reuben, and his wife Martha. And Esther, Nathaniel's only daughter, all stood in shocked distress. The one surviving son missing was Pearlie, the youngest of the brothers at age 20. The Gates brothers, all strong, hard-working men, were cast in the same mold, but were not identical after the final polishing. Reuben was born a serious man of high morals, with a sense of responsibility and total dedication to the family. John was equally moral, but somewhat less serious in his approach to hard work. He was the strongest of the three brothers, but not by very much. The youngest, Pearlie, seemed not to be bothered by much of anything, taking whatever was offered at the dawning of each new day with the same open mind that he had the day before. The only one of the brothers who had not married, Pearlie had never exhibited any urgency to find the right woman, although his brothers accused him of being particularly fond of a young woman who worked in the diner in town. He was awarded the unusual and often fight-provoking name Pearlie Gates, to honor his grandfather, the original Pearlie Gates. When his grandfather was born, his mother had named him Pearlie, in hopes that it might help guide him to a righteous life that would see him approach the Pearlie Gates of heaven at his life's end. She was not an educated woman, so she misspelled his name, but that made little difference to the family. The name proved to have minimal influence upon the life of the original Pearlie Gates, for he was born with a lust for wandering and a constant yearning to see the far side of the mountain. To his credit, he tried to harness his adventuresome nature, even to the point of taking a wife and trying to scratch out a living on a hardscrabble plot of ground in North Texas. His wife died not long after giving birth to their one son, Nathaniel,
who was named after his wife's father. The boy was raised there on the farm by his mother's parents, after Pearlie reached the end of his patience for the hard work of farming, and left Texas to seek the peace he sought in the mountains to the northwest. Some years later, Nathaniel learned that his father had actually made it no farther than the San Bois Mountains in the Indian Territory of Oklahoma, and was rumored to be living with a Choctaw woman in a shack somewhere in that small range of mountains. Nathaniel had no desire to contact his father upon learning that. It was not until years later, when he started his own family, that he began to understand the nature of his father, and truly forgave him for his wanderlust. It was this change of heart that inspired him to name his youngest son Pearlie, to show his sincere forgiveness, unaware that of his three sons, Pearlie was the most like his namesake.
"Pearlie!" Sonny Rice yelled when he saw him near the edge of the river. Pearlie looked back from the bank to see the young hired hand loping toward him on the little paint mare the boy most often rode. Pearlie turned his attention back to the steer on the end of his rope and continued to back his horse up the bank. By the time Sonny rode up to a spot beside him, the cow Pearlie was in the process of rescuing found solid footing and scrambled up onto the bank. Pearlie dismounted and removed the rope from the cow before asking, "What's up, Sonny?"
"It's your paw," Sonny exclaimed. "I think you must have died. Everybody went running up to the house, and John sent me to fetch you."
Pearlie was immediately concerned. Like the rest of the family, he had expected to hear that his father was beginning to recover.
"Are you sure?" he asked.
For some time, Sonny got things mixed up in his head.
"Did anybody say Pa was dead?"
"No, but they was all acting kind of worried, and John told me to fetch you in a hurry."
"All right," Pearlie said. "Let's get going, then."
He looked back at the cow he had just pulled out of the area of quicksand to make sure it didn't venture back toward the same section of river bank. When the steer trotted away to join the other cows farther up the river, Pearlie climbed back onto his horse and started toward the house. Pearlie was not prepared to deal with his father's passing. Nathaniel had always been a paragon of strength and endurance that all of his sons tried to emulate. Now, as Pearlie rode the 2 miles back to headquarters, as the ranch was referred to, he hoped and prayed that Sonny had leaped to the wrong conclusion. But he feared the worst. As soon as he pulled his horse up to the front porch of the house, he guessed that Sonny's assumption had been correct. John and Martha were out on the porch talking, and they stopped abruptly to greet him when he came up the steps. Martha's eyes were red from crying, and she held tightly onto John's arm as he relayed the sorrowful news to Pearlie.
"Papa's dead, Pearlie," John stated solemnly. "Reuben and Lou Ann and Esther are in the bedroom with him. And Mama."
Pearlie shook his head slowly but made no reply. Martha released John's arm long enough to step forward and give Pearlie a firm hug before stepping back beside her husband. She wondered if the youngest son had had a premonition of his father's death, because he had acted strangely ever since he came back from town a few days ago. John had told her that Pearlie wanted to work alone out on the range with the cattle. She would not be surprised if Pearlie had received some kind of message in a dream or something. There were folks who got those sorts of messages, and Pearlie was strange in a lot of ways. Nathaniel Gates was buried on a grassy slope 50 yards behind the main ranch house, just beyond the 2 small cabins that his married sons lived in. The funeral was short and simple, just as her husband would have preferred, according to the grieving widow. The three sons dug the grave and built the crude coffin their father was to spend eternity in, using some of the lumber bought to repair the bunkhouse. On the day after Nathaniel was laid to rest, the family gathered to discuss the management of the ranch from that day forward. It was assumed that Reuben would inherit the role of overseeing the operation of the cattle ranch, with no objection from either of the 2 younger sons. There was no one better qualified, Near the end of the family meeting, another item was brought up for discussion by the widow.
"There is one wish I know your father would have," Rachel said. "He talked to me many times about his father, and his desire to make amends with him. He came to forgive his father for leaving him with his grandparents after his mother died. His grandma, who raised him, had always told Nathaniel that his father couldn't help himself for his desire to wander."
Rachel paused to brush away a tear.
"Well, your papa never found time to search for his father and tell him that he had named Pearlie after him. So now, I think we should try to find your grandpa and let him know that his son has passed away. I think he should know this."
"I don't see how we're gonna do that," Reuben said, "unless we go looking for him. And we've got too much work to do here this time of year."
All hands on the ranch were preparing for the spring cattle drive, planning to start out for the railroad in Ogallala in 2 weeks' time.
"One of you boys can go," Rachel insisted. "I think we owe your father that. He wanted so much to make things right with his father. So we can at least let your grandpa know about his death."
Reuben still looked uncertain, so Rachel continued.
"I think Pearlie should go look for him. You and John have wives to take care of. Pearlie doesn't, so I think he should go."
"Mama's right," John said. "We ought at least tell the old man about Pa's death."
He looked at Pearlie then and asked, "What do you think, Pearlie? You want to ride up in Indian Territory to see if you can find Grandpa? If he's still up there in the Sand Boys Mountains, you ought to be able to get up there and back before we start the cattle out for Ogallala."
Pearlie shrugged indifferently. "I reckon, if he's still there, and if Mama thinks that's best."
He didn't express it, but any chance to get away from the routine of the ranch was always welcome, even in unhappy circumstances like these. When there were no objections from anyone, he shrugged again and announced, "I reckon I can start out in the morning." Reuben walked out of the room with him after the family meeting. When out of earshot of the women, he spoke to Pearlie.
"I think it's important what Mama wants to do, and I hope you can find the old man up in those hills. But Pearlie, if you can't find him in a week, come on home. We need you on that cattle drive."
"I will," Pearlie said.
Since no one in the family knew for sure how to find his grandfather, Pearlie determined to start out on his search the next morning. He'd follow the Kiamichi River up into Indian Territory until reaching the Kiamichi Mountains. He figured when he struck those mountains, he would head north of the river, hoping to find the Sand Boys Mountains, where his grandfather supposedly had his camp. Once he knew he was in the Sand Boys Mountains, his plan was to find someone who might know his grandpa and be able to tell Pearlie how to find the camp. "If that doesn't work," he told his brothers, "I reckon I'll just comb those mountains till I stumble on Grandpa."
"Well, don't keep looking for him forever," Reuben repeated. "If you don't find him after a week or so, come on home. He might have moved on to God knows where."
Pearlie nodded in reply.
"You got everything you need?" John asked. "You're gonna be gone for a while. Make sure you're taking enough bacon and hardtack and coffee. I reckon you've got plenty of cartridges for your rifle."
Pearlie couldn't help chuckling. His two older brothers were fretting over him like a couple of worried parents.
"I reckon I'll make out all right," he said. "I think I've got everything I'll need, and as long as I've got my rifle and cartridges, I reckon I won't starve."
With everything ready, he threw his saddle on the big bay gelding he favored most. Working cattle, he used many different horses, but the bay was his personal horse. He was named Buck after Pearlie's brother John bet him a dollar he couldn't saddle-break the horse. Pearlie not only won the bet, but in the process gained a four-legged friend that bucked off every other rider who climbed on his back. It didn't take long before all the crew at the Triple G Ranch learned that it was no use cutting Buck out of the remuda, because they wouldn't stay in the saddle for long before the horse came back to the barn looking for Pearlie. His brothers chided him for making a pet of the horse, but they could not deny the big bay's strength and stamina. On hand to see Pearlie off, one of the older ranch hands, Fred Farmer, was there to offer his help. Fred had spent a great deal of his life in the mountains of Oklahoma, and suggested the best way for Pearlie to start looking for his grandfather was to go to a trading post he knew about in that part of the country.
"What you ought to do," Fred advised, "since you don't really know that country, is to follow the Kiamichi River up through the Choctaw Nation. It's going to be about 65 miles or so after you cross the Red, but if you stay on the river, you're bound to strike that store. It's run by a feller named Russell Byers. I reckon he's still there. If he ain't, his son's most likely running the trading post. There ain't any other places up that way for folks to buy supplies that I know of."
"Appreciate it, Fred," Pearlie said. "That's just what I'll do." Ready to ride, he held up when his mother came out on the porch and called to him. She walked down the steps to stand at his stirrup.
"Here," she said, and handed him a small velvet pouch. "This is the locket your grandfather gave your grandmother when they were married. Your grandfather might not believe you if you tell him you're his grandson. Show him the locket inside this pouch, and he'll know."
She stepped back then, and he put the pouch in his inside vest pocket.
"And son," she said, "you be careful, and come back home safely."
"I will, Ma."
He said goodbye then and rode out of the yard on Buck, leading a sorrel packhorse, heading north toward the Red River, 2 miles from the ranch. Once he crossed over into Oklahoma territory, he would start up the Kiamichi for about 20 miles or so before resting his horses. Behind him, his brothers stood watching him until he passed through the front gate.
"Damned if that ain't a waste of time," John commented after Fred Farmer had left them to return to his work, and their mother went back inside. "There ain't nothing up in that part of the country that would have kept Grandpa there for very long."
"I expect you're right," Reuben replied. "But if it'll bring Ma some peace, I reckon it's worth wasting a little of Pearlie's time. I don't know if that old man is still alive after all these years. If he was, he might have come back to Texas before now." He shrugged and said, "Maybe Pearlie can at least come back and tell her that Grandpa's long gone from there."
"I hope he'll be all right," John said. There was a definite hint of concern in his remark.
"Grandpa?" Reuben asked.
"No, Pearlie," John answered. "He's got a natural knack for walking right in the middle of trouble, when nobody else even comes close, and he's been acting kind of quiet the last few days."
His comment brought a chuckle from Reuben.
"He didn't tell you?"
When John looked puzzled, Reuben continued, "He thought that little gal in the diner in town was shining up to him, and he found out she's been shining up to every other bachelor in the county. So he's been feeling kind of foolish for thinking about courting her." He chuckled again. "I told him he just ain't learned enough about women yet."
"Well, I swear," John chuckled. "I told him that he's gonna have to start going to church to find the kind of gal he's looking for. Hell, Lucy Tate shines up to me every time I go in there."
Although his brothers felt a little sorry for him to have been saddled with a futile endeavor, Pearlie was of no such frame of mind. In fact, he was looking forward to what he perceived as an adventure and a welcome break from the usual mundane ranch chores. He had always held a curiosity about the man he had been named for, so who could be a better choice to go in search of his grandpa? As for the subject of Lucy Tate, he was grateful now that he had found out what a flirt she was before he made an even bigger fool of himself. It was toward the middle of the second day when he came to the trading post Fred had told him about, a low log structure sitting in a clearing close to the river bank. The store appeared to have had two additions built onto the back of it. No doubt to accommodate a growing family, Pearlie thought. He must be doing fairly well. As if to attest to that fact, there were three horses tied in front of the store at the hitching rail. In addition, there was a barn to one side of the store with several horses in the corral. Pearlie dismounted, looped Buck's reins over the end of the rail, and walked inside. He paused at the door to allow his eyes time to adjust to the dimly lit room. A fire in the stone fireplace at the far end of the room was the only light, other than a lamp on the end of the counter. "Well, howdy, stranger!" A tall, thin man behind the counter greeted him. "It's getting a little raw outside, ain't it? I reckon the good Lord ain't ready to call it summertime yet." "That's a fact," Pearlie replied. "That fire yonder looks mighty friendly." He glanced toward a table near the fireplace to see three men seated and obviously warming their insides with the contents of a glass jar. All three paused to take a good look at him. He turned his attention back to the man behind the counter. "Would you by any chance happen to be Russell Byers?" "No," he said, smiling. "I'm Bob Byers. Russell Byers is my pap. What can I do for you?" "You know a man named Pearlie Gates?" "Pearlie Gates," Bob replied. "Can't say as I do. Is that really a man's name?" "Yes, sir. He's my grandfather. And last we heard of him, he's roaming these parts. Thought you might have seen him down this way." "Well, like I said, I ain't never heard of anybody named Pearlie Gates. But maybe my pap has," Bob suggested. "You want to ask him?" "Yes, sir, I surely would. Is he round about?" "He's sitting in the kitchen drinking coffee," Bob said. "Come on, and you can ask him." He led Pearlie to a door in the corner of the room that led to the kitchen, and a white-haired old man seated at a long table. When the door opened, the old man looked up quickly and asked, "Bob?" "Yeah, it's me, Pa," Bob answered. "I got a feller come to see you, looking for the Pearlie Gates." "Well, he ain't likely to find him looking in here," Russell Byers replied. "I'm looking for a man named Pearlie Gates, Mr. Byers," Pearlie said. "I'm hoping you might know something about him." It occurred to him that the old man was almost blind, judging from the way his gaze seemed to have trouble finding him. "My name's Pearlie Gates, too. The man I'm looking for is my grandpa." "Pearlie Gates," Russell responded. "That's a name I ain't heard for a while, and that's a fact. Pearlie used to show up here every now and then, but not since my boy took over the store. And that's been over a year ago, ever since I got so damn blind I can't see what I'm doing." He reached for his coffee cup, just managing to grab it before he tipped it over. "You want some coffee? I would offer you something stronger, but I never sold any liquor. It's against the law here in the nations." "I don't ever turn down a cup of coffee," Pearlie replied. He figured that Russell's son must have branched out into the whiskey business unbeknownst to the old man after he went blind. Thinking of the three men he had just seen in the store, he doubted that was apple juice they were drinking. "Ruby!" Russell yelled. In a few moments a woman walked in from a back room. "Pour Mr. Pearlie Gates a cup of coffee." Ruby, who Pearlie guessed to be a Choctaw, went to the cupboard at once to fetch a cup. She filled it and placed it on the table before Pearlie, giving him a faint smile before turning and leaving the room. "Now, about your grandpappy," Russell continued. "Did you look in that camp of his?" "No, sir," Pearlie replied. "That's my problem. I ain't ever been to his camp, so I'm hoping to find somebody who can tell me where it is." He went on to explain why he had never seen his grandfather and the purpose of his search for him after so many years. "I need to tell him that his only son, my father, just passed away. We heard he had a place up in the Sanboys Mountains, but I ain't got no idea where in those mountains. To tell you the truth, I ain't sure how to find the Sanboys Mountains. I don't know much about the Oklahoma Territory this far east. The only time I've ever been in Oklahoma is on cattle drives up through Indian Territory on the Western Trail up to Kansas. Russell slowly shook his head and scratched his beard thoughtfully before responding. "Well, I ain't never been to old Pearlie's camp myself," he said. "But I reckon I can tell you how to get to the Sanboys Mountains." "That's a start," Pearlie said. "I'd appreciate it. Save me a lot of time." "It's a pretty far piece from here," Russell started, "about 50 miles. But it's an easy trail to follow. Just make sure you take the right one, 'cause there's quite a few trails branching off from the river track that brought you to my store. They're going to different little settlements and farms, but the one that runs straight north to the Sanboys is easy to find, if you know what to look for." He went on to tell Pearlie to continue following the river trail for about another 4 miles until he came to a long, low ridge running parallel to the river. "There's a gap in the middle of that ridge, and the trail you want runs right through it. You'll know it. There's a big old cottonwood bent over almost to the ground right next to it. At least there was. I reckon it's still there." They talked for another 20 or 30 minutes before Pearlie took his leave, because Russell was happy to talk about Pearlie Gates. Listening to much of what Russell remembered, Pearlie learned that his old grandpa was somewhat of a character. "I surely do appreciate your help, Mr. Byers," Pearlie finally declared, "and I thank you for the coffee." "Not at all, Pearlie," Russell said, extending his hand. "You stop back to see me. Let me know if you found your granddaddy." Back in the store, Pearlie thought to thank Bob Byers as well on his way out. Before he reached the counter, he heard the taunting call of his name. "Pearlie!" One of the three sitting at the table called out, sounding close to a bird call, causing his two companions to chuckle. This was not the first time Pearlie had encountered someone mocking his name, so he ignored it and kept walking. "Pearlie Gates!" One of the other two called out then. Evidently finding it to be hilarious, they all laughed heartily. With no desire to rise to the bait to defend his name, especially with three drunks, Pearlie continued to the bar to thank Bob for his help. He was a little irritated to see Bob with a wide grin on his face, and knew at once that he had informed the drinkers that his name was Pearlie Gates. "Wanna thank you for your help," Pearlie said anyway. "I enjoyed talking to your pa." Behind him, he heard the unmistakable sound of chairs being shoved back from the table, and he knew he was going to be unable to avoid a confrontation. He turned to face the challenge, relieved somewhat to see that there was only one man walking toward him. The other two had just pushed their chairs back in order to more comfortably watch the fun certain to come. A fairly tall man, although gangly in his build and walk, favored Pearlie with a drunken grin. It was easy to guess he and his friends were most likely small-time outlaws, maybe cattle or horse thieves. Aided, no doubt, by the courage found in a jar of whiskey, the man strode up unsteadily, stopping almost in Pearlie's face. "Is your name Pearlie Gates? Like them gates up in heaven?" Aware then that the man was even drunker than he had first appeared to be, Pearlie took a step back to avoid his breath. "Yes, sir, it sure is. Only it ain't spelled the same," he answered. "What's yours?" This seemed to confound the belligerent drunk for a moment. "Ain't none of your business what my name is," he finally slurred. "I reckon you're right," Pearlie said, favoring him with a friendly smile. "It was mighty neighborly of you to come over to say howdy. I'd like to stay and chew the fat with you, but I expect I'd best get along."
"What's your hurry, friend?"
The drifter took a step closer. Forced to take another step backward, Pearlie was still determined to avoid the trouble the bully was just as determined to provoke.